While there were too many copies of his works to make the plan practical, it is said that the great philosopher Plato wanted to gather up every one of Democritus's manuscripts into a great bonfire, and thus be rid of them forever. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. While Plato did not get his wish, history has not been kind to the works of Democritus. Born in Thrace about 458 BC, Democritus traveled widely in the ancient world and produced some 60 works of philosophy and science. But all we have left is about 7 pages of fragments. Yet to the modern reader, those fragments are intriguing in large measure because they sound so modern, beginning with his view of the physical world. Nothing exists, he said, except atoms and empty space. Everything else is optional. Wyoming Catholic College philosopher Dr. Michael Bolin recently taught Democritus, and I asked him to begin by commenting on Democritus's materialistic view of the physical world.
Of course, the thing that Democritus is famous for is atomism. Everything's composed of atoms, and to the modern ear, that sounds like Democritus was basically a modern, because we think things are composed of atoms. Now, there are some differences between his, a lot of differences between his conception of atoms and our contemporary conception, but that's at the root of it. Like the other pre-Socratic philosophers, one of his primary interests was, what's the material world made of and where does it come from? And so he had this theory that things are made of atoms, and I don't know if you want me to talk about the reasons behind that theory.
Sure.
The earliest philosophers were really interested in the question of change. How is it possible that one thing changes? Trees grow and decay, and the material world is always in flux. And one of the famous pre-Socratics, Parmenides, said, nothing changes, it's impossible. It's all an illusion, therefore. And that sounds very strange, because we see things changing all the time, but Parmenides had an argument. He said, nothing can come from nothing. And that principle sounds good to a lot of us today still. And so if you take a log and you burn it, it turns into smoke and ash, and Parmenides would say, where did the smoke and ash come from? Did they come from nowhere? Or did they come from the log? What does that mean exactly? The log ceased to be, and smoke and ash began to be. How is that different from smoke and ash coming from nowhere? And Parmenides said, this is impossible. So there must not really be change. Right? And that might not sound compelling to us. Maybe we don't have that kind of rationalist mindset. I don't know. But I think it did sound compelling to a number of Parmenides' contemporaries and successors. So people like Democritus really wanted to struggle with that question. How could it be that a new thing can come to be? Doesn't that mean something comes from nothing? And Democritus said, well, we can't just say there's no change. That's ridiculous. We see it all the time. But what we could do is try to explain change in terms of not change at root. So in order to avoid the difficulty of something coming from nothing, Democritus says, it must really be that all things are made of the same stuff. Because that would, in other words, the smoke and the ash are really the same stuff as the log. And we need to say that in order to avoid saying that they come from nowhere, right? And so how could these very different things, smoke and ash, be the same stuff as log? Well, maybe they're composed of really small things that are all the same, arranged in different ways. And that's sort of the basic idea of where his atomism comes from. He couldn't have any really direct empirical evidence, the kind of things we might point to today, but it's more a kind of philosophical argument to say, we do see change happening, and we can't just deny it like Parmenides. But we can only explain it if, at root, things are made of the same stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the basic root behind the idea.
Right, but it also went with a philosophical materialism. I mean, he had no sense of God or the gods.
Yeah, one of the... I don't know how much detail is known about that, but it does seem to be true that the so-called pre-Socratic Greek philosophers are much more interested in nature as opposed to divinity. In fact, you might say one of the things that distinguishes the first philosophers as philosophers from the poets is that they want to draw a sharper line between nature and divinity. So in the ancient Greek mythologies, right, you see natural entities sort of are divinities. Night and the sun and the moon are gods, right? There's this just nature and divinity are conflated, as it were. And the philosophers basically said, no, we're going to draw a distinction. And so they said nature is not God or the gods. And they started investigating nature. And some of them, I think pretty naturally, began to think, well, nature is self-explanatory. So maybe we don't even need the gods at all. So you might say it's a reaction to the excesses of the Greek mythologies that sort of pushed the Greek philosophers away from believing in divinities. Socrates later on ends up being accused of atheism for this, even though it's not clear that he really is an atheist as such, as we would think of it. But what he is he doesn't believe in gods that are anything like what Homer describes, for example.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, let's move on to his ethics. I mean, on the one hand, his ethical fragments sound like simple good common sense. And behind them, it seems to be what C.S. Lewis called the Tao, that is, natural law. Is that fair to say that he had a sense of natural law?
That's my impression. I don't have a lot of expertise in his ethical fragments, but my reaction is the same as yours. They make a lot of sense. He's interested in justice and the things that the Greeks called democracy and temperance. So it all sounds good on the surface. This doesn't seem to have any basis in any kind of revelation for him or his contemporaries, so it seems to be natural law. And that's what St. Paul says, right? The Greeks have the law written on their hearts. And we seem to see that with the philosophers, including the ones who may have been atheists. So that's my sense as well.
He says in one of his fragments about moderation and character, he says, "The hopes of right-thinking men are attainable, but of the unintelligent are impossible." I mean, that seems eminently reasonable and practical, and people ought to think about that a bunch.
Yeah, another thing that I think the Greek philosophers were really interested in is how man is different from the other animals, and that they all recognize this has to do with his rationality. And so maybe that's a fragment as a way of getting at that idea, right? If you don't live in accord with your rationality, then you're going to be no better than a beast, and the life you will have is going to be no more than they have, right? There won't be any distinctly human achievements to it. Mm-hmm. So,
well, also you'll be constantly unhappy.
Right. There's something to be said for that, right? It's the is it John Stuart Mill later on, much later on, who says it's better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied.
Now, how does that all play into his role of government? He talks about democracy. This is the city decision-making group and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, democracy on a much smaller scale than, say, we have today. But I think, in a way, it flows out of the same thing, right? Going back to, like, prehistory, these ancient mythologies and whatnot, you have a much sharper sense of hierarchy among human beings. You know, in many cultures, some human beings, the rulers are basically divine or semi-divine. Therefore, they have this divine right to rule. But for someone like Democritus, who's a materialist, it's much more natural to say, no, everybody is the same, right? No one has a sort of natural right to rule. Nobody has a divine right to rule. And so the only just form of government would have to be more democratic. So I think it may, in fact, flow out of the natural philosophy at that level. Mm-hmm. Plus, maybe just experience with the way tyrants behave, right? So,
I thought one of the oddest bits of the fragments has to do with children. Whoever wants to have children, he said, might do well, in my opinion, to choose them from the family of one of his friends. That way you can, you know, so you can pick what you want. Whereas if you beget a child, well, it's a roll of the dice and you're stuck with whoever happens to show up. You know, that seems very modern in terms of, you know, our talk about surrogates and sperm donors and genetic manipulation and so on.
The ancient Greek version of designer babies, I guess. Nothing new under the sun. Yeah, well, I guess there too, it feels to me like materialism is at the root of it, right? If you dwell on that too much, you start to think, start to lose a sense of like distinctly human ethics. I mean, as we said earlier, he's clearly not a hedonist or a nihilist in a moral sense. He certainly promotes justice and whatnot. But maybe he's closer to what we would call utilitarian. The way you determine what is good for man is by the useful in this sense. So if you want healthy children, right? Better not to gamble. Maybe that's not something we should ultimately endorse, but I can see how it would come out of could come out of that more materialist conception of things. And yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, he comes across as being just very urbane, very reasonable, the kind of guy that you'd like to sit down and chat with for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. That is a sense that I've gotten reading fragments of a number of the early Greek philosophers. Right? And maybe it's related to what I was saying earlier, right? They're very in touch with thinking, how should I behave on the basis of the fact that I'm a rational thing and not just an animal that has desires like any other animal? And maybe I think that's the consequence.
Now, it's reported that Plato wanted to gather up all Democritus's works and put them in a big pile and light them on fire so no one would ever read them. Why would that be?
In his Socratic dialogue, Phaedo, Plato has this passage where he shows Socrates talking about the views of the pre-Socratic philosophers. And Socrates says he really admires the philosopher Anaxagoras, because Anaxagoras says mind, intelligence, is the principle behind everything. And then Socrates goes on to say, but when I actually read the books of Anaxagoras, he was just giving a materialist, mechanist explanation like everyone else. He didn't actually make use of mind as a principle when push came to shove. And Socrates was unhappy. Why? Because, he says, the reason mind is a true explanatory principle is because minds, intelligences, act for the sake of what is good. And the good is always the best explanation for things. So he says, for example, if you ask me, why are you sitting here, Socrates? And I say, I'm sitting here because my bones and tendons and muscles are arranged in such and such configuration. You'll think that's an idiotic answer, right? That's not what you mean when you say, why am I sitting here? You want an explanation more like, I'm sitting here because I think it's good for reasons X, Y, and Z, right? He says, the better explanation is always in terms of the good. So he doesn't deny there are natural material explanations for things, but he says, if you really want to know, you have to ask about the purpose, the goal, the good. And so that's sort of Socrates ends up sort of rejecting, as does Plato, the fundamental approach of the earlier philosophers, because he says they weren't going for the most important thing, understanding why it's good for the world to be this way, instead of just saying, how is the world? And that's why Socrates ultimately turns to more ethical, philosophical questions. But I think the thing about Plato and Democritus comes back to that Plato thinks, following Socrates, that this obsessive focus on the material nature of things makes us lose sight of what is more important, the good, right? So to say, even if it's true, things are made of atoms, right? If you want to understand a human being, you also have to ask, what are human beings for? What is the good of a human being? Not simply, how are their bodies composed? And I think that Plato thinks, and maybe he's ultimately right about this, that obsessive focus will ultimately lead to a loss of virtue, even if you don't see that immediately with someone like Democritus. But that's sort of the end game, once we lose sight of the fact that the good, what Aristotle later calls the final cause, is the most fundamental explanation for things. So I think it may have to do with that. Plato sees that line, that whole way of thinking about the world, as ultimately bringing us to a bad place.
Which makes Democritus and that whole debate rather contemporary, it seems.
Yeah, in fact, I read some of the fragments of Democritus with our high school students in our high school program frequently, together with a famous article on defending abortion, which we've talked about in a previous podcast. And what I want them to see there is that even though you might think ethics and physics are these hugely distinct areas at first, eventually they come together. Even if it doesn't happen right away, our views about the physical nature of things end up affecting our general view of nature, and ethics comes from nature ultimately. And so eventually there's a tie-in, and I think Socrates and then Plato following him sees that more clearly maybe than their predecessors do.
Philosophical errors, like theological errors, are hardy perennials. The same ones keep popping up again and again through history, vainly challenging the truth revealed in natural law, in the scriptures, and preeminently in the person of Jesus Christ. As the philosophical and theological fads of our day wax and wane, it is that truth, the truth of the faith once delivered to the saints, as St. Peter put it, that lights our path, shows us the way, and draws others along with us. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.